You're listening to Object of Sound from Sonos, the show where we bring you in tune with the music that shapes our culture. When music lives in the air, it's one thing, but when you know the undercurrents and the ideas that went into a song, and when you can feel its weight, it becomes more meaningful. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, a poet and culture critic, and I'll be your guide as we seek a deeper way of listening. For some people, when they think of quote-unquote political music, they return immediately to the iconic protest songs of the 60s and the 70s, thinking about the work of someone like Marvin Gaye.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you cry.
Or Pete Seeger.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Or even Mahalia Jackson in the civil rights era.
We do believe, Lord, we shall overcome, Lord, one day.
And although these songs are so memorable, the way they're heralded as the protest music kind of dilutes the idea that protest music is still being made today and still being made effectively today. And it also limits protest music to a set of ideas that are expressed through explicit and clear language. But there's a whole tradition of jazz music that is just as political and does the same work sometimes without language at all. This is a track from Uneasy, an album released today by the pianist Vijay Iyer and the trio he worked with, Taishan Sori on drums and Linda Mahan Oh on bass. The album is immensely political with tracks on it like Children of Flint and a song called Combat Breathing made after the death of Eric Garner. And the album also uses sonic movements to kind of stand in for language, to kind of make these statements that language would otherwise hold. And listening to Uneasy got me thinking a lot about musicians who have made protest music without words, or the way that musicians have chosen to sonically protest during performances or in recording booths, and how jazz fits into a long tradition of largely disenfranchised artists fighting to have their work heard and respected, and how that, for me, feels inherently like political music. So today on the show, I'm going to talk with Vijay Iyer about creating music for and about our current political moment. We're going to talk about the arc of his career, what went into making Uneasy, and we're also going to talk about the history of jazz and what it means for him to be a scholar of Black music and Black culture production. And then I've put together a playlist of deeply political music that is independent from lyric, from artists like Jimi Hendrix and Alice Coltrane. You can hear that on Sonos Radio or on mixcloud.com/Sonos, and we'll leave that link in the show notes. And we'll close the show with a final thought about one of my favorite jazz musicians, Nina Simone. Vijay Iyer is a pianist, composer, and a scholar whose work has spanned across many musical communities. He's released over 24 albums of music, received a MacArthur Fellowship among many other accolades, and currently teaches at Harvard University in the Department of Music and the Department of African and African American Studies. Vijay, good to see you. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, good to see you. Thanks so much for having me. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I'm such a fan of your work and excited to talk about your journey in jazz in general.
Well, I'm a fan of your work too.
Can I ask first about your journey? Because something fascinated me about your journey, which is that you were playing music on the side while getting a degree in math and physics, which, of course, several musicians come up playing music on the side of doing something else. But that feels like a taxing, as someone who's not good at math or physics, that feels like a taxing journey. Was it?
Well, I guess the question was, when does the side become the center? I mean, music has been a part of my life since I was a little kid. I'm not sure that I ever really felt like I was great at it, but I knew that I loved it, and it just took up a lot of my everyday life somehow. You know, I grew up taking violin lessons and playing piano by ear, so there was always something to kind of like keep me occupied. What the piano was for me as a kid was like me trying to play Michael Jackson songs on the piano, you know, stuff like that. Like,
right.
What I heard on the radio, I wanted to somehow also do, you know. It wasn't even really about figuring it out. It was just like, I want to do that. As I got older and felt like I was supposed to study something legit, stable career path or something, I didn't know. I didn't really know what I was doing. But it seemed like people like me were supposed to study science and math, I think. I mean, it was partly that I was in my family, you know, my parents being from India and being a particularly the curated population that was allowed to immigrate from India in the 60s. And those people were people with scientific and technical educations. They were the kind of people who valued that. And so I learned that that was the way to be somehow. And so music occupied this space of pleasure, space of exploration, but I never thought of it as a professional pursuit.
There's something I really want to unlock with you about politics, of course, because I'm so interested in the recent project, but also because I was thinking about my own journey through jazz, which was first coined by Nina Simone, who I understood as explicitly political at a very young age. But so much of the politic was resting in the lyric for her. And I'm interested how to hear you talk a bit about jazz as a form that is political, sonically independent of lyric, or how sound, too, can be a form of expression of politic.
Yeah, that's a deep question, because we're not dealing with pure representation in a sort of one-to-one kind of way. Often what we're dealing with is relationships and backstory. When I think of the history of jazz, I'm thinking really of the history of Black people making music defiantly, that creative force of defiance, of, you know, a kind of refusal to be silenced and an insistence on being heard on one's own terms. So those kinds of acts are political acts. And, you know, to me, the quintessential example is Strange Fruit.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the lead and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Not just because of what that song is about, but the circumstances in which Billie Holiday brought that music into the world and made her audiences face it and endure it, you know. So then it was like, okay, you came here to listen to ballads and blues to see a pretty woman with a magnolia in her hair, you know, but now you're going to have to face something about yourself.
Here is a strange and bitter cry.
So that's a moment of confrontation. So then I think about, like, what does that sound like even beyond the lyrics? Where can you hear those moments of confrontation? Sometimes you can hear that energy. You know, sometimes I listen back to, like, Coltrane live at Newport. So what is Newport? It's this jazz festival on a wharf in Rhode Island, where like people have yachts.
Right.
You know, so most of the people there either own a yacht or related to someone who owns a yacht, you know? So, so then you're like, you're listening to Coltrane playing to them. And so can you hear in that sound something like, actually, fuck this, you know, like that kind of like critique of the circumstances that they're in that moment, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's sort of, I listen for that, I guess. And you know, it becomes a kind of almost a spiritual practice. And I learned a lot about this from, I was incredibly blessed to have the chance to work with Amiri Baraka for years. I was in his band. And I mean, I learned something about listening from witnessing him as a listener, like how he listens to people, you know, how he hears the spirit in the music, how he hears a history of a people, how he hears an individual personality, the highs and lows of their lives in just the sound. And so that quality of listening that has a sort of ancient kind of insight into who a person is.
So this is a perfect segue to Uneasy, which I'm very interested in part because I have so many questions about Uneasy, it's going to be hard for me to kind of piece them out. But one, it was recorded, if I'm going to understand, it was recorded like over a year ago, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And back 2019?
Back when that was easier to do, you know?
Yeah, right. Whereas, what has it been like kind of sitting on the recordings, which are, of course, political in nature, during a year like 2020 that has flowed into 2021, where the ever-present political circumstances of America have been more tenuous for some than they traditionally are. And for some, they've been, of course, like a reminder of the forever nature of the country.
Right.
But what has it been like kind of sitting on this recording and waiting to release it to the world?
Well, some of it was that I had to piece it together. You know, we had these session files, and I knew that there was at least an album's worth of stuff there, but then it's like, what is this album? You know, like, what did we make actually? What is it saying to me? What is it saying to us? What might it say to the world? And this was, you know, 2020 was a time when the word political feels kind of bland for what we were really dealing with, right, which was like apocalypse. Like, it really felt like apocalypse, you know? So it was really, you know, when you are thinking like, okay, I'm going to put this out, part of what you're saying is, okay, I think we have a future. This album will have a future. This band will have a future. We will get to play concerts. We will get to share music like we used to. And that feeling was really hard to summon, I have to say. I think what gave me the most optimism was the season of protest that we were all a part of last summer, which was that sense like, well, here is a whole movement, a whole uprising of people who are fighting for their futures, fighting for our shared future. So that was where it felt like, okay, how can we serve this? You know, how can I as an artist serve that sensibility? Not certainly not like capitalize on it or something, but really just like, okay, because that sense of hope came from the streets, really, like came from just outside the window here, I felt like that was what I wanted to give back to.
Is there a point in your career where you feel like, a simpler way of asking this is the when were you radicalized question, but I think a more nuanced way of asking it is there a point in your career where you felt a pull to pursue a more political undercurrent in your music, or not even undercurrent, but like a very present tone in your music? Or do you feel like by the virtue of who you are and the type of music you make, there's always been a pull towards the political?
It's a combination of what I have lived and then what I've witnessed, then also like having been mentored by these defiant, incredible Black American artists in particular, you know, including Baraka, Butch Morris, Wadada Leo Smith, George Lewis, Steve Coleman, Henry Threadgill, Muhal Richard Abrams. I mean, these are all people who, it's not even that it's about being overtly political, but just that kind of defiant sense of purpose and possibility in the face of great odds. And so bearing witness to that and just wanting to ethically participate in that stream of great artistry and bring something to the table that is genuine, I think that's sort of where it all comes from. And I also would say that a lot of it just is born of collaborations and relationships, you know, like working with someone like Teju Cole or Mike Ladd. You know, it ends up being most of what we talk about when we spend time together. Mostly we're talking about the world and trying to make sense of our place in it.
This is an interesting thing because you are someone who also teaches Black music and teaches histories of Black cultural production. And I feel like you have a lot of thoughtful things to say about being a person who teaches these histories, who is not a Black person. How have you moved past the complications that perhaps come with that and continue to do the quality of work that you do both as a creator and an educator?
Well, it's certainly, I don't know if moving past, does one ever move past those things? I don't know, but I felt that if someone was going to use the word jazz in relation to me, that I wanted to hold them to, or just I wanted to remind them that that word doesn't just come out of nowhere and it can't just be applied wantonly without some inquiry, at least, about what that word has done and meant to different people and for different people. And so I just find that I'm always like wanting to remind people that, like, if you think you're a jazz musician, it's kind of like when Baldwin or Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about, if you think you're a white person, you know, like, so if you think you're a jazz musician, then you need to catch up about certain much deeper facts about who and what we are as Americans, and what your relationship to those histories does for you and what you think you can do as an artist in the face of all that. So I guess, you know, when I'm dealing with students, particularly students who are trying to make music, it's like, let's study this history. Let's study not just music as some abstract style, but music as a history of people, a history of communities, and try to understand the choices they made on their terms, you know, in the context that they were made. I should say also that, like, I wasn't initially hired to do that in particular. You know, when Harvard hired me, it was like, well, you're an artist. We're trying to hire more artists. So come here and be an artist at Harvard. And then I didn't really know what that would entail. When I got there 7 years ago, I just tried to observe, like, what were students thinking about? What were they aspiring to do? How could I help them do it? One thing that happened is that, like, for me, in the Department of Music, I ended up being the only senior faculty of color, which meant that people would come to me with needs or with questions or just would want to, like, come hang out in the office and, you know, like, vent or commiserate or something. You know, that's what happens to faculty of color, right, these institutions. So I felt like I wanted to create a space where they felt safe and they felt like they felt seen and they saw themselves reflected in the curricula. So that's sort of like how it developed, I would say. And then that meant that I could create my own courses on my own terms. And then after a few years, I was also cross-appointed in the Department of African and African American Studies, which is, you know, Henry Louis Gates and until just now, Cornel West, and just incredible scholars, So that meant that I was part of a different and larger conversation. And then I wanted to have courses that would speak to those conversations and create a little bit more crosstalk between those two departments, between the Department of Music and Department of African-American Studies.
To dip back into Uneasy here, do you believe Uneasy? First of all, do you think Uneasy is an optimistic album? I know that it's ushered into the world on the wings of some optimism of a future where we can be together. But, in the creation of it and now when you listen back to it, does it feel optimistic to you?
There's a reason I chose that title. And it's basically expressing a sense of precarity, right? You know, there was already a piece by that name that we had recorded, and in fact that I had composed 10 years ago when precarity was in the air or somewhere beneath the surface. But we were brought into stark contact, or we were reminded anew of how flimsy our systems are, last year when it all felt like, for example, as a music maker, I guess the whole performing arts world can just like wash away in months. Mm. It doesn't take much to just make it go away, like disappear, possibly forever, to have to be rebuilt. And then what is optimism in the face of precarity? I think about this phrase, do you know Lauren Berlant's book?
Absolutely.
Cruel yeah. Optimism, right?
Yep.
And that's something that's like, very specific to living under capitalism, which is like there's a bit of a hoax. You're being, what's the word? Malcolm X's line, like, you've been took.
you've been bamboozled, hoodwinked.
Yeah, so there's this sense like optimism is a trap, But at the same time, like what it is to make music, there's no way that you can make music for others without feeling some sense of possibility, like possibility for connection, possibility for empathy, possibility for a shared future. And so we're always like weirdly right in the middle of that question. Even someone who makes really gloomy music, they're still making it, they're still making it and offering it into the world.
Yeah.
Even if it's like, here, come be gloomy with me, you stranger who I may or may not ever meet, you're now in community with me. So how is that not an optimistic gesture? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I love that sentiment. I mean, with that in mind, though, what would be a satisfaction point for you then with this album? Was this an album where you were kind of like, I want to change the hearts and minds of this sometimes wretched land, or are you satisfied to just have the album enter the world and live as it will live?
It's funny because Tyshawn and I can both be like pretty dark. We're pretty dark characters. He actually like routinely wears all black. I mean, probably every photo you've seen of him.
I've never seen him wear anything other than all black.
Making music together or just making music at all is a space where like, what's that? The other Baldwin line is hope is remade every day. And it can be the space of newness. In this space, we make new things.
I love that. To kind of wind us down a little bit, because both those sentiments were lovely. So every week on the show, I make a playlist that's kind of themed. And I usually ask the guests to help me to contribute some tracks to it. And as we mentioned earlier, I've been thinking a lot about specifically jazz tracks, but tracks that are instrumental in nature, no lyrics, that still feel political, that are maybe getting at those tensions you were mentioning. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned Newport, because I was going to put a live Newport recording on there, just in my brain, because I was thinking about that.
Yeah, you know where that first like really clicked for me? It was a few years ago. It was after Jerry Allen passed. And Terry Lynn Carrington and Esperanza Spalding had this trio with her.
Yeah.
And they were actually booked to play at Newport. And Newport's in August, and she passed at the end of June. So what they decided to do was ask a few of us to play with them, to sort of like each play a couple of pieces in her honor. And one of the pieces that she liked to play, it's by Charlie Parker. It's called Al Lu Cha. And so I hadn't played that in like 20-something years. So I had to go back to some recordings just to kind of study it. And I found this one of Miles at Newport. And this is with his 50s band. But Coltrane had left the band already, and then he came back just for this thing. And in between, he had worked with Monk for a while. And so he's just sort of bouncing through, and the ferocity of him playing on this tune in particular, that was like, oh man, he is telling these Newport denizens to fuck off. Like, that's basically what's going on. And like, and at the same time, it's so full of exuberance and possibility and newness, you know, like he's really pushing on it. Almost like he's channeling that oppositional energy into something really incendiary and brand new. That's what it feels like to me. So that's one example, I would say.
Do you have another one? Can you drop another one for me?
The one that came to mind for me is not really instrumental, but there's not a lot of lyrics in it. It's Jimi Hendrix, Band of Gypsies, and that piece, Machine Gun. Which to me is like one of the greatest pieces of music of the 20th century. That like incendiary, volcanic kind of energy. You can't believe it's happening, you know? And the way he frames it, if you remember that intro, he says like, well, this next one's for that draggy scene that's happening in Detroit and Los Angeles. He names all these American cities, and he's like, and oh yeah, the stuff that's happening in Vietnam too. So it's like an anti-war anthem that's actually about the domestic war of like basically of white supremacy. So
all the soldiers that are fighting in Chicago and Milwaukee and New York. Oh yes, and all the soldiers fighting in Vietnam. But they do a thing called machine gun.
Yeah, that's a perfect choice. That's an incredible choice.
Yeah.
Vijay, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for your work and for the way that you think about music, and importantly to me, the way you think about history and how it impacts the present.
Thank you, Hanif. It's great to be in conversation with you, and I hope it's not the last time.
Vijay Iyer's newest album is Uneasy, and it is out today. As a final thought, I want to talk a little bit about Nina Simone, who I love a great deal. My first memory of Nina Simone was hearing her version of Pirate Jenny when I was a kid. And I don't remember who had it on what record in my house, but it was from 1964, the 1964 performance.
You people can watch while I'm scrubbing these floors, and I'm scrubbing the floors while you're gawking.
You know, Pirate Jenny has its origins in the Three Penny Opera, and it is a song that is largely about vengeance. It's about a maid working in a hotel who draws ridicule from townspeople.
You couldn't ever guess to who you're talking.
And the song unravels with her imagining getting revenge on the town people, which involves a pirate ship with 8 sails and 50 cannons entering the harbor, firing on the city and destroying every building except the hotel, and then the pirates coming ashore and chaining up all the townspeople and asking Jenny what she wants to do with them. You know, Jenny has to decide their fate, and she decides that the town people should be killed at the hands of the pirates before sailing away with the pirates.
The black freighter runs a flag up its masthead, and a cheer rings the air.
But through Nina Simone's lens, the song felt to me, it haunted me, because it felt as though it were about revenge for slavery. It felt like it was enacting what I would later come to believe was a slave revolt. And it was so visual. The way that she kind of slowly built the arc of the narrative and built the ship as it arrived, that it felt like I was envisioning ghosts becoming ever more present. And that, I think, is Nina Simone's greatest tool of not only song articulation, but actually her greatest tool as a political artist, was that in her hands, every song that she repurposed, even if it wasn't meant for Black folks, felt like it was speaking to a very real, tangible Black experience. Another great example of this is the song Black is the Color.
Black is the color of my true love's hair.
Which originally has roots in the Scottish folk tradition, but Nina Simone singing Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair, through her lens, it becomes this beautiful ode to Black love.
His face, so soft and wondrous fair.
And the politics of Nina Simone lived best, I think, yes, in her explicit language from beyond the piano, you know, the things she spoke about in interviews, the things she spoke about when not singing at her concerts, but really an incredible strength of hers is how she transmitted and re-articulated songs that were perhaps not meant with Black people in mind and made them distinctly ours. This has been Object of Sound from Sonos. Thank you to our guest this week, Vijay Iyer. To hear all the music and the full version of the show, listen on Sonos Radio or find us at mixcloud.com/Sonos. And while you're there, check out some of the other great shows on Sonos, including Radio Hours featuring Laurie Anderson, Adrian Young, and The Weather Station. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. If you love this show, rate it and share it with your friends. Also, tell us what you like about the show and what you're listening to. This is a communal thing, music discovery. Let us know your thoughts in an email. We're at objectofsound@sonos.com. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Sonos Radio. This show is produced by Work by Work, Scott Newman, Gemma Rose Brown, Babette Thomas, and by me, Hanif Abdurraqib. The show is mixed by Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. Extra gratitude to Joe Dawson and Saida Blount at Sonos. I'm always talking about music online on Instagram and Twitter at Neef Muhammad. Thank you for listening.